A child, I used to get into trouble huge amounts, both at home and at school as well. I was regularly in trouble with my teachers and seemed to be very impulsive and get into lots of messes that I regretted a lot of the time. But something that used to really strike me when my mum usually was telling me off about my latest misdemeanor was that she'd say to me, "Who do you think you are?" And I'd kind of look at her and I'd think, well, I'm me and I've obviously done something wrong. And how do you want me to answer this? Because even at a young age, my sense was me just telling my mum I was me and what was she on about was only actually going to get me into far more trouble than I already was. But it's quite a big question, isn't it? It's a profound question. Who do you think you are? And it's something maybe that we all think about a bit. It's something that's captured society quite a lot. I think that some of you might have heard of the BBC hit TV series, Who Do You Think You Are? And it's now in its 14th series since it first aired in 2004. If you're not familiar with it, it charts the family tree of various celebrities and it consistently tracks millions and millions of viewers. And apparently many have been inspired to go out and trace their own family trees as a result of it. But I just wonder why this desire, this topic of having a deeper understanding of who we are, has captured the interest of so many. I was working recently with a lovely person one-to-one. They're really, really struggling, this person. They've been struggling a long time and suffering in a lot of ways. And I said to this person a while ago, "Who are you?" And I think they captured the essence of this really, really well, this why it's so important, because they said, "I don't know anymore. And that means I don't know what my purpose is in life, and it's lost meaning." And so it was tears coming down their face. And I think that was just a really profound and insightful observation as to why this question is so important. Because our identity or who we are is just so much about, you know, my name or where I live or the communities I'm in. It gives us value, meaning and purpose and much, much more than that. But in the culture we live in today, I think most people understand who they are in terms of what they do, what their job is. So their value, meaning and purpose is largely defined by their occupation. If you say, "Who are you?" they might say, "I'm a teacher," or things like that. I remember a number of years ago, well, quite a while ago, before Sophie was born, we lived in London at the time, and I used to go along with Richard to various corporate events. I must say, I really, really disliked them, but I went along to them. And there was always this really difficult bit where you'd usually sit down for dinner with people you didn't know, and the person next to you would say, "What do you do?" And that would be the opener in to where you were going with that discussion. And I remember at the time, I was working as a psychologist in London, and I was contracted to MI5, working with their spies. So if you said that to someone at the dinner table, it would often cause a lot of interest in what you were doing, and people would have lots of questions. But I remember once, I then took time off for maternity leave when I had Sophie. And I went along to another one of these things, and I was sat down ready for the meal, and a woman was sat next to me, and she turned to me and said, "What do you do?" And I turned to her and said, "I'm a stay-at-home mum." And her face just dropped, and she actually said to me, "I'm really sorry." And maybe that is, I don't know, is it funny? Is it shocking? Is it sad? I don't know. But actually what was really, really sad was I didn't disagree, because deep inside, I didn't know who I was either. I didn't have any value or purpose. I'd lost the sense of who I was because I'd given up work and I felt I had nothing to offer. I'd like to say since becoming a Christian, my thoughts on that have changed dramatically, but that's where I was at the time. I was lost. I had no value, no sense of purpose, no meaning. I didn't know where I was. But who we are, it's about so much more, isn't it, than a job? Because those who don't have a job title, for lots of different reasons, don't cease to be any less of a person, do they? The core of who we are is just so much more. It's about our abilities, our character, our experiences, our beliefs, our goals, and it's most clearly understood, not by me just telling you who I am, but it's understood relationally through the interactions of the communities we exist in every day. So how we understand who we are affects how we live and what we live for every day. It affects how we think, how we feel, both physically and emotionally. It affects our behavior, what we do or don't do, because it involves motivation and it involves purpose, and it affects how we perceive others and also how others perceive us. But we live today, don't we, in a very individualistic culture. And in that culture, what it means is objective truth is replaced by subjective reality. So what this means is birth identity is no longer accepted in the way that it used to be. Now it's something that we create and we can control. And the social media phenomena that Miriam has been talking about, things like Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, all of this and many, many more, mean that essentially identity now in the society we live in today has become more of a self-branding exercise. We create a persona, and as it goes out on social media, echoes back what we want to hear from followers who agree. So who do you think you are in the society we live in today has more become who do others think I am? I really, really don't want you to think this is a dig at social media or technology, because actually I love it. I think there's a lot of really, really helpful things about it. But we've got to be really wise. We've got to be really careful. This is the society that our children are grown up in. And it's not just about social media. It's social media combined with the cultural values that are bombarding into our lives constantly. And whilst we as adults have seen this develop over the last decade, our children haven't. This is the situation that they have been born into. And this is all that they know. And the impact is enormous. You see, our identity is highly influenced by the voice we hear the loudest and the most frequently, and this is what's coming at us all the time. There's cultural voices that come through social media, news channels, politicians, friends, family, things like that, and they're saying things like this: gender is fluid, not binary. Sexuality is just an expression of freedom. Sex is between the legs, and gender is in the mind. Just go with your feelings, be true to yourself. If my needs aren't met, I'm going to go somewhere else to become happy and fulfilled. As long as you're healthy, wealthy, and happy, that's all that matters. If you don't believe what I want you to believe, you're intolerant. As long as you don't hurt anybody else, it's fine. It's not my fault, it's just how I am. Or it's my right because I'm worth it. Well, something that we're hearing more and more frequently, eminent scientist David Goodall recently said, the worthiness of life is my choice, as he booked into a clinic in Geneva to end it. So these voices that come at us all the time help form beliefs about identity that I read myself in a local discussion forum I was lurking on recently. Somebody commented on there, a person is whoever they tell us they are. And what was really interesting was that virtually everybody on that forum was congratulating this person for making such a wise comment and speaking so brilliantly into the situation. And this combination of cultural voices and technology do something really, really powerful. I wonder if any of you here have heard of something called amputee identity disorder. It's a really, really traumatic disorder. And what happens is people will believe that although they have a fully functional body functional limbs, that they will truly believe that their identity is actually somebody who doesn't have an arm or a leg. And it's very, very specific. So it might be that I don't have a left arm from below the shoulder blade, or a right leg to the thigh or under the knee. It's very, very specific. And the people that are suffering from this are really, really suffering every day. But what is happening now, given the voices that they can meet together in social media and other technological forums, mean that there's affirmation coming back at them all the time with other people that are agreeing with this. And recently, there's been lots and lots of documented cases of surgeons actually removing healthy limbs in order for this identity to be lived out, because increasingly we live in a society that says if you don't agree with what I want you to believe, you're intolerant, and there's litigation that is possible. How can I keep this person in this mental suffering by not amputating a healthy limb? I just wonder how that might develop over the next 10 years. It's an area that is, there's a lot of ethical implications in it, but in the mental health area, it is well documented, and increasingly this is actually being lived out in these people's lives by the limbs being amputated. There's just research starting to come through now as to, you know, what impact that has on those people. Is it largely positive or negative? Most of them at the moment are saying it's very, very positive. It's interesting to see how this will develop. But voices that are coming at us that say, yes, I feel that way too. I don't think I should have a left arm. Hey, there must be something to this because it's not just you. This is coming through social media, and it does something very, very important when social media is combined with these powerful voices, because voices aren't just heard. Social media operates on a very, very powerful reward-based system. So things like likes or followers or equivalent do something very, very important. And it's probably something I'd imagine most people aren't even aware of, because every time something like this affirms something we want to hear, dopamine is released in our brain. It's a neurotransmitter, and it's often nicknamed something called the motivation molecule or a reward chemical, because it's so dominant in the brain's pleasure reward system that goes on, and it provides drive and focus in that pleasure reward system. So when we're exposed to a novel or rewarding stimuli, like an affirmation through a like or a follower, or things like that, dopamine is released. We get a sort of dopamine hit, a feel-good hit. It surges. And the more these likes and followers or other things we see on technology, like fast-paced, very, very quick, changing, colorful images are so commonplace on our screen, these reward connections are made in our brain, and we're getting these feel-good dopamine peaks going off all the time. But this is why they're so addictive, because the more these dopamine hits happen, the more novel the reward has to be to get the same effect back. If the reward imagery also includes sexual content, it is even stronger, because the hormones that are released when we're actually watching sexual content, content that connect with the dopamine, are just huge. And every time this neural pathway is created and reactivated through repeated exposure, it will become the preferred and easiest route of mental travel. And this is why technological design is so addictive in nature. In fact, it's true to say that often designers will be put on courses in basic neuroscience to actually optimize this effect. So a lot of the programming behind it is all about how do you click through another image and another image, because it's releasing this dopamine surge every time it does it. And that mental route that becomes then so natural in our lives, it affects what we live for every single day. It impacts our decisions, our behaviors, our emotional fluctuations, our relationships. It determines what we're motivated and live for every day. So our identity isn't just distorted at a psychological level in who we believe we and others are. It's reinforced at a physiological level as well. And whenever our identity is based on rewards that are external to us, like likes and affirmations and things like that, we've made ourselves very emotionally vulnerable, because they're always likely to change or disappear. So the further our chosen, created identity moves from our true identity, the more emotional tension it creates. That disjuncture that comes significantly contributes to some of the unprecedented levels of emotional disorder we see, sadly, in our society today. You see, anxiety rises because created identities need to be protected. And anger erupts when people don't agree with us, because creative identities need to be served. They need to have these likes and affirmations coming through to survive. And it's ironic, isn't it, in a society that desperately pursues, having real problems with this stand. In a society that desperately pursues peace and happiness all the time, and it's often met by connecting with others or imagery through our screens, in fact, the levels of fear and dissatisfaction have just increased beyond all description. It's ironic, isn't it, that the most downloaded app in 2017 was one called Calm, and it aims to reduce stress and anxiety and increase happiness and self-esteem. And yet the research that's coming through that's saying the more we look at our screens to get this, the more unhappy and lonely we're becoming. An app is there that we're staring at on our screens to reduce it. So what can we do? Because as Miriam's already alluded to, we can't just say don't do it. We can protect our children, and we do need to be wise and sensible about when we let them access these sort of screens and the sort of stuff that we're looking at on them. Obviously we do. We need to have discernment and knowledge ourselves, and we need to teach that to our children. But banning them just isn't the answer. This is the life they are going to live is the reality of the culture that we're in. And this is going to be very, very normal. And as soon as technology is there, these are the risks that are going there. We can't just say no. We have to have a robust understanding of who we really are as we're looking at all of these things. And we need to teach that to our children too, so that they have the security of a robust understanding themselves. See, whether our children are verbalizing that question or not, as I was leaving here tonight, Kezzy said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to do a talk. She said, what on? And I said, who do you think you are? I said, so who are you? And she said, well, I'm Kezzy. And I said, yeah, and what does that mean? And she said, well, I'm just Kezzy. And it was interesting, you know, because while she couldn't verbalize it, you could see she was thinking about it. And how does that look as she goes about trying to get affirmation from people in different ways every day? See, we need this robust understanding, don't we? So how would you answer for yourselves and for your children? Is identity fluid? Is it just what you want it to be that day or that week or that year? Is it bolstered by affirmation that are coming, likes and things like that from other people? Or in fact, is it uniquely given, providing value, security, meaning, a purpose at the deepest level? You see, no amount of self-branding on social media, hormone therapy or surgery will change the fact that if you took a tiny drop of blood from my finger or a single hair from my head, the core fabric of my identity and your identity too, who we really are going to be revealed by our DNA. And that identity is ordained by the one who knit me together and you together in our mother's womb. The one who knows my thoughts before I've even spoken them. And the one who sees the deepest desires and motives of my heart. And as terrible as they are, sometimes he still loves me. You see, God tells us through his word who we really are. And not only that, he tells us how that identity is going to look in the fallen world we live in. And this means that from his word, I know things about every single one of us sitting in this room. You see, every one of us here is going to get angry sometimes, and we don't even know why. We feel far more afraid than we let on. We feel shame. There are things about us that we would be horrified at the prospect of other people finding out. We all worship. We worship what we live for, and we live for what we worship. And maybe, like some of us are thinking right now, when we feel vulnerable, when matters of the heart are starting to be addressed, our natural response is we deflect that discomfort by blaming others and pointing somewhere else. We all prefer to live our life our way, not God's way. In the Bible, it's known as that very, very politically incorrect word these days. It's called sin, and sin notably has a great big letter I right in the middle. I want to do things my way and live for my kingdom come, my will be done, My guess is you do too. In a world, I think, that we live in, which is obsessed by spectrums and diagnosis, actually, as we look at this biblically, we're all on God's great spectrum. There's no them and us. We are all far more alike than we're different. We're all needed and we're all needy, aren't we? There are times of blessing and there are times of suffering for all of us. It's the reality of living in a fallen world. We're all made in God's image. So his character is found in everyone, even those people that you have to dig really, really, really deeply to find. And we all look and act differently for a specific purpose. The fact that I'm green-eyed, very short and freckly, and I'm utterly rubbish at art is no mistake. It's just how it was planned to be. And we all fall short of God's standard, and we're incapable of meeting them. Which means that we're all in desperate need of a saviour, aren't we? Which God in his grace and mercy has given us through Jesus' death on the cross. You see, the purpose of all of our lives isn't to glorify ourselves through the identities we create for everybody to affirm. The purpose is to love him and love others. And our unique characters, gifts, looks, family situations, and weaknesses and struggles all help us to achieve those things. So the more we accept and embrace and live for who we really are, instead of who we're trying to be, the better we're equipped every day to live for his glory. You see, we're free, aren't we, from living on that ladder, that rung of a comparison ladder, wondering if we're above or below, better or worse than all of those around us. And instead, we can sort of turn that ladder on its side, can't we? And instead of standing on rungs, we're perhaps all in those bits in between each of those rungs. We're all uniquely different. We're all created for a specific purpose. But as we look alongside those around us, we all fall short of the only standard that matters, the standard that only Jesus Christ meets. And as we look to him, he provides the perfect template of what it means to be fully human. And through forgiveness at the cross, we're progressively conformed more and more into his likeness. And you see, the more we're conformed into his likeness, we value others more. We're more compassionate and more respectful to those who aren't like us at all. We have more humility and we love others well. And when we understand who we really are, we know more value, security, meaning and purpose in our lives because it's found in the unchanging God. It's found in the God who's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And the God who says he will never leave nor forsake those who trust in Jesus Christ. So we've all got a choice, haven't we? As we sit here today, we've got a choice to where we turn to find our value. To find our identity and the value and the meaning and security and everything else, the purpose that that identity brings. We all have a choice. And that makes a choice. Where we turn makes a difference to how we live and how our children will live every moment of every day. So who do you think you really are?